This is Being Healthy with Dr. Christian Bramwell, discussing all things health, fitness, and wellness. The opinions provided should not be viewed as medical advice. And remember, please consult with your doctor before making any changes to your diet or habits. Thanks again for listening, guys.
How's everybody doing? Welcome to the Health Deep Podcast, where I got a very special guest this week, Dr. Christina Cruz, graduate from The Ohio State University, majoring in biology with a minor in personality and social psychology. She received her medical doctorate from Ross University School of Medicine, and is now in her second year of residency at the Family Medicine Program at Augusta University with yours truly. Everyone, say hello to the talented Dr. Christina Cruz. So, Christina, just for the audience out there, you want to fill them in on anything that I might have missed out and tell us what you're working on currently right now?
So, as the year goes on, I'm actually working on two big things right now. I'm in the midst of doing some great research with all the new laws associated with the opioid crisis. My research is currently focused on prescription drug monitoring of controlled substances. And so we're in the middle of phase two of our research. So phase one, we were looking at our current prescribing practices here at MCG to see if we were being compliant with the state standards, as well as seeing ways that we could improve our compliance with state standards. And so we're moving into our second phase of that research now. We are doing an intervention. We're doing some education for our physicians and PAs and nurse practitioners that are in our clinic here in family medicine. And then I'll be able to present that research in November in Toronto at the Nat Craig North American Primary Care Conference. So that's a pretty great thing.
Okay, it's in Toronto, right?
Yes, it's in Toronto this fall.
Okay, that's my home country. So make sure you enjoy it for myself, okay?
I most definitely will.
Okay. Okay, so guys, welcome to the podcast. And also, Saeed, how you doing this week? This podcast wouldn't be the same without you, my cousin.
Doing all right, but I'm going to hang back and let the medical experts, the medical professionals take over today. So, just teach me. Let me learn from
you. You know, you always still teach us something, man. Said anything finance or law related, we definitely expect you to chime in now. Don't be bashful, okay?
If it comes up, I'll jump in.
All right, you better, man. You better. But all right, guys. So as I said, so for this week's podcast, our topics are going to include schooling and now that it's back to school season for most kids across the country. So the key issues we're going to talk about is public versus private school, the pros and cons of each, and whether all it makes a difference. Then we're also going to talk about common issues that kids face going back to school, including mental health issues like bullying, ADHD, nutrition, as well as activities for schooling. We talk about what issues parents could face, going everything from head lice to after-school programs for kids. And then besides that, we're still going to finish up with a general discussion about school and finish up with some core questions as well. But first, I want to ask Dr. Christina Cruz a couple of questions so that we can get to know her a little bit better now. So, Dr. Cruz, so tell me this. So, first of all, is becoming a doctor everything that you thought it would be cracked out to be or not? Like, what have you taken away from these first about year and a quarter of residency so far?
So, being a doctor, especially being a primary care doctor, it has been a combination of things that I expected and things that I didn't expect.
Okay.
There are a lot of long hours, and there's a lot of opportunity to bond with your patients and to build a great working relationship with them to help them get the tools that they need to improve their health. And so I think that this last year has been a really great growing experience in that aspect, that I've learned how to be a better doctor, a better listener, a better friend for my patients, be a better advocate for their care as well.
I got you. And how would you say the program here has been? I'll give you my opinion first, but I want to hear you first. How do you think the program's been treating you so far?
The program has been great. We've been working really hard. I didn't expect anything less as far as the work goes, but the work is hard. As they say, the days are long, but the years are short. So it's going pretty fast.
Okay. See, I'll say this. I'm I'm ecstatic. As I said, like, as Dr. Cruz says, we do work hard, but I'm very happy to be doing this hard work. If for y'all don't know, I worked at Publix for 8 years. At first, I thought I wanted to go into management at Publix, but, you know, I decided to do the medical career, and it was probably for the best choice. But as I said, working at Publix, you did get to make an impact in lives, but it's so much more of an impact in medicine, because with this white coat, we have the power to have people open up to us in a way that really it's not really seen in too many other fields. So that's, I feel like I'm blessed with that. Albeit, yes, the hours are hard. You got to work hard. You got to call people all, and people be calling you all types of things. But hey, it's a give and take thing. But what were you working? Did you have a job? What were you doing before medical school, Dr. Cruz?
I've had quite a few jobs in my journey to med school. I've essentially worked part-time or full-time since the age of 15.
Okay.
A combination of jobs, anything from fast food to medical billing and coding. Those are two jobs that I did in high school.
Okay. You told me you were like a manager at Kroger or something like that.
I was an assistant manager for Aldi for 3 years.
That's it.
While I was in college. And it was a great experience learning how to work with people, learning how to manage a business. A great, wonderful experience. And also put food on my table while I was a poor college student. So
wait, you had food on your table? You had food?
Yes,
I'm joking.
I worked hard to put that food on my table.
I'm joking. We do be eating as medical students. It's just hard between the amount of time we have to do and the loans. But so Dr. Cruz, tell me, like, out of all your experiences, what skills or what tools have you used or have applied in the doctor in as becoming a doctor? Like, in terms of like any like leadership skills or like customer service skills, like what skills do you think are the most important that you've had learned that you're applying now as a doctor?
Well, skills from previous jobs, customer service is a huge one. We work in a service-based industry. Physicians are serving their patients and serving their staff, and we are just constantly taking care of those around us. And I think that's one huge thing that I've gotten from being a, you know, being a manager as well as being a daughter, sister, mother. You just kind of learn to have that mindset of service, that you're providing service for people and taking care of them. One of the other things that I've definitely developed over these last few years is the ability to survive on a sleep deficit.
Okay.
There were times in college where I was working 48 hours at a time.
48 hours?
At a time.
At
yeah.
a time.
Yeah.
Were you pregnant or was your...
No, I was working two full-time jobs.
Okay.
At the time. And so... We, as well as a few experiences in med school where we were up for days at a time. And residency has come with its own set of 24-hour shifts. And thank God that it's only that long.
As you guys can tell, Dr. Cruz, she works a lot harder than me. Me, I'm a lazy man at heart. I just like, as she said, I just like eating food on my table. So that's where my motivation comes from. But Dr. Cruz, she does have plans to be the future chief of the family medicine department next year. So since you're doing all the good things to earn my vote, so you got one vote here, Dr. Cruz. And then besides
He's spilling all my tea, guys.
Hey, it's worth it. The tea is some high quality tea. Okay, and then besides that, I think one thing that you said is that you said it's important to make the best out of any situation to be resilient. Like, can you just like explain like any situation like in life or in residency where you felt like you had to use that resiliency?
There's definitely been more than one instance in med school and in residency. For those of you that don't know, Ross University is a Caribbean medical school. And so the basic mechanics of that is that you spend your first 2 years in the Caribbean doing your basic sciences, and then you come back to the States and you do your last 2 years of clinical science education in the United States in teaching hospitals in the U.S. There were a lot of responsibilities that were left on our shoulders as students. Anything from coordinating our own rotations to chasing down the attendings after the rotation to make sure that your evaluation got filled out. If you didn't get the evaluation filled out and signed by the attending while you were there, it almost never got done. And so they've now since hired some really great coordinators to assist them in all of that administrative work. But back when I was a student, there was a lot of that administrative burden that fell on you. Being a Caribbean student is not for the faint of heart.
I got you. But taught you that resiliency, though. Taught you that resiliency, though. Something they got you.
Yeah. It's a great skill to carry through your life and to carry through this great job that we have, this great career.
I agree. And then besides that, yeah, y'all, and just for all you know, so pretty much there's the United States and Caribbean schools. Both, if you graduate from both of them, you can still become a doctor. It's just, as Dr. Cruz was saying, it's just the Caribbean route is a little bit more of a roundabout way. Still gets to the same destination, but
it still takes 4 years. It's still a regular med school.
But
there's no roundabout about it. You still graduate with your MD. I graduated in 3.5 years from medical school, so it definitely can be a traditional path. It's not preferred.
Okay.
Everybody would prefer to be an American medical graduate. It makes your life and opportunities a lot easier. But I have colleagues that went on to graduate and match into orthopedic surgery residencies, ophthalmology residencies. Lots of very difficult ones. And the large majority of us do go into primary care. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I would like to, you know, pass on to anybody who's looking to go to one of those Caribbean schools, is that you're most likely going to get matched into a primary care residency.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to be very, very driven and high performing in order to get out of that primary care trap if you're not interested in primary care.
Okay.
It's a harder road, much harder road.
Okay.
But you can do it.
Yep. But you guys are going to get there. One of my good friends, he just graduated Barbados. I forget which school that was in.
Actually right now Ross is in Barbados. They just moved in the fall of 2018 after the last set of hurricanes that had come through and ravaged the island of Dominica. The school, after 40 years, decided to make the move and jump from Dominica to the Barbados.
Okay. Okay,
that must be it.
Yep. So he graduated from Ross. He's in Ventura, Miami, right now, doing internal medicine right now.
Yep.
He's drowning, but it's okay. That's why he's got big brother Christian over here to help him drown.
I'm sure he is doing fantastic.
Thanks to me. I'm joking. All right, just a couple of quick lightning questions. These are like just some quick yes or no questions, just before we get out to the main topic. Okay.
Sure.
Cats or dogs?
Dogs. Violet? I have three. Beautiful, wonderful fur babies.
What kind of dogs you got?
I have a golden retriever. He's my oldest. He's been my world traveler, my ride or die, my shotgun rider.
Okay.
he's traveled all over the world with me. That dog's been on more planes than most people I know.
Okay.
My middle child is what we lovingly call a coconut retriever. So the island dogs in Dominica, the ones that are local to the island, they don't really have a breed. They're more just mountain dogs, and so we lovingly named them coconut retrievers.
True.
So he's my little coconut retriever, and then my youngest little girl, she is a corgi mix, and we actually adopted her from Augusta Animal Services here in Augusta last spring, right after I took my last board exam, step 3.
Nice. All right, now quick. Who do you think best college football team out there?
Clemson, the Ohio State University.
It's Clemson or Alabama. Oh, you can't even catch a lava, right? All right. Next question. Where would you rather vacation? Cancun or Montego Bay?
Montego Bay. And my reasoning for that is that Jamaica has a lot more hiking trails and ability to go out into the community than Cancun does.
Okay.
Cancun's a little dangerous right now.
Okay, I got you. And that's one more thing. As far as music, are you country, rock and roll?
Rock and roll, all the way.
Okay. Particular artists you like in particular?
I have an array of artists that I love that are all rock artists. I most recently went and saw Killswitch Engage and Parkway Drive when they were in Atlanta last spring. That was awesome.
That's what's up.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, guys. Hope you got to know Dr. Cruz a little bit better. Again, this is the Health D podcast with Dr. Bramwell, co-host Saeed Bramwell Gordon, special guest Dr. Christina Cruz. You can find us on healthd.com, healthd.com. And we have the links for our various communications and social media platforms below in the description. All right, so public school and private school. So growing up, as I said, Saeed, I know we grew up in the same family, so our moms sort of think the same. But growing up, my mom was always about private school. She would specifically work extra shifts, and she worked her way up from a nurse assistant to an LPN to an RN. Now she's a nurse practitioner, but all growing up, she was a big believer in education. She was like, Christian, if you can do one thing, get a good education, that is something no one can ever take from you. And don't do it, and don't study anything stupid. Emphasizing that don't study anything stupid. And she was a big believer in education. Even when I was gung-ho with football, I wanted to do football so badly. But luckily for my mom, she was good enough to tell me how bad I was in a very polite mom way with a hug afterwards, but tell me I was not so good. I need to focus on education. And it was the best thing that ever happened, you know what I mean? So because of the education that I got, especially through Incarnation Catholic School, Jesuit High School, University of South Florida, and Morehouse School of Medicine, I became the man I am today. And I'm sure you guys have some tales as well, too. But she was a big believer on the private school. So right now we're going to talk about public versus private schools and just give some anecdotic tales on what's better. And I'm going to throw in a couple key statistics in on the whole argument on if there's one necessarily better than the other. So let's start with Dr. Cruz. So growing up, did you go to public school or private school?
So growing up, I actually grew up in a very rural town. And so private school, the nearest private school was an hour and a half away. So I did not go to private school, and it was actually something that was financially out of our reach as a family, with the two siblings as well. So we had one option where I grew up, and that was public school. And I think that that's a case for a lot of people as well, is that the opportunity isn't really there.
Everything public?
Everything. Okay. Everything. Yeah, we didn't have anything else.
Okay.
Out in the cornfields, I like to say.
Okay. It's like, what about yourself? Tell the audience, like, were you public, private?
Well, just like you, it was all private. Being that our families are from the islands, it's sort of like being in America, you sort of have the luxury of finding good schools that are public schools. But in the islands, for the most, it's a private school education.
Mm-hmm. So, and where'd you go to, and just tell everyone where you went to school at?
Jesuit High School with you, and then, you know, college with USF, and then Vanderbilt Law School. But just that private school education, it's, you know, we sort of drink Kool-Aid just because we hear it so often. Quite a few public schools in the U.S. that are phenomenal, and their students do really, really good schools. There are a lot of public schools out there that really, really are leading the way in education in the States. But just from the West Indies, like, expected that if you go to a good school, it's probably a private school, but you have different luxuries here, different opportunities.
Oh, yeah. And just to give some tales, like, so usually you go to school, for instance, in most other countries in the world, so school is not as necessarily as free as it here is in America. And by free, I just mean mobility. So usually in order to advance, say, from like high school to college to study a certain craft, you have to take an aptitude test. You know, there's no, and while we do it here in America, it's far more selective because with school being funded by the government only has so many slots. While here, you know, there's a lot of private schools where they can, there are a lot of donations that people can get to fund schools. In most other countries, it's funded by the government. And because of that, the schooling is very, very cut, as a very cutoff where you're not good enough to go into college. You have to pick up a trade or figure out something else. But luckily here in America, as we said, the public school system is designed to make sure that everyone has an equal opportunity to learn, so that the opportunity is equal for everybody. So, Dr. Cruz, let me ask you this. So starting off with public schools, like, what would you say is like the biggest things first of all, your children, like you said, like, you have a daughter, correct?
I do. I have a stepdaughter.
Okay. So would you ever be gung-ho public school or private school, or do you feel like, you know, you could either go one or the other without too much of an opinion?
Well, so it really just depends on availability. So, number one. And number two, it depends on the quality of the schools in the area. So as the school system, public school system, is built and funded through property taxes, the property taxes of the homes in that area. And so you normally find your schools with higher resources, higher quality educators in neighborhoods with higher median property values. And so that leads to an inherent system of inequality, unfortunately. It was designed back in the, I think, the early 60s or 70s. Don't quote me on that one. So that public schools would get the appropriate funding that they needed, that the homes of the children that were participating in those schools and enrolled in those schools would get the funding from essentially from their parents' income. And so there are some great public schools. I know of a ton of magnet schools in Atlanta that are just absolutely wonderful. There are a couple in the Roswell area that are actually direct pipelines to Ivy League colleges, which is just an amazing opportunity for those kids. And there are kids all throughout the city of Atlanta that end up going to those magnet schools. But those magnet schools are designed for certain specialties. They're designed, there's one for arts, there's one for STEM, and a lot of public schools, especially out in more rural areas, once you get out of suburbia, there's a lot less opportunity. Just to speak from my experience, my school, we got our first advanced placement course in my junior year of high school, and we only had two. By the time I graduated, we had four, and now I believe they have more like 8 or 10 classes that students can take. They also had a great program where you could go to the local community college when you were a sophomore through senior year of high school. If you had, if you were high performing, then you could go and you could get classes there, take classes on their campus and get free college credit. As long as you stayed within the state of Ohio for your undergraduate career after that, you were able to actually transfer those credits over. And that gave me the ability to take an entire year off of my tuition bill. Because I came into college at Ohio State when I walked into main campus on that first day with enough credits to be a sophomore.
And in Florida, we had like a Bright Futures, like to help, like I said, like state in state. We had a Bright Futures scholarship in Florida. Here it's a Hope. What was it called in Ohio?
The Hope Scholarship is a federal scholarship. And they have, that's available in all 50 states. Ohio State does have quite a few scholarships as well. I ended up getting a half tuition scholarship off of merit. I ended up being the salutatorian in my high school.
Salutatorian. For all that don't know, that means she was the second biggest boss in her high school. And then the reason why I prefer private schools, as I said, like, not to be like, I'm not trying to be elitist or anything like that, but I feel like there's more of a homogenous opportunity in private schools. While you're right, in public schools, while that is very, like, how it does, you know, it should create equal opportunity for everybody. But say, for instance, where we go, like, for instance, Laney High School right next door in Augusta. So at University of Augusta, there's this high school next door called Laney. So in Richmond County, the demographics are fairly homogenous when it comes to wealth distribution, that white, black, Hispanic. It's one of the, it's generally a less well-off county than others. And because of that, you can really see that in the facilities, it's not up to par. So let me ask, so do you still feel like at public schools, even though like in areas like where Laney is, still offers students an equal opportunity? Or do you feel like it's just too much of an advantage on where you live to dictate how well your education is?
I think that that has historically been the case in the past. I think that in the past, there's been a lot of inequality when it comes to opportunity for students that live in lower income neighborhoods, and that the idea behind the magnet schools that they developed in the 90s was to redistribute that opportunity. And so that's why they're busing kids to these magnet schools all the way across the city. But that also brings you to a point where you have to, you get into those schools on merit. So you have entrance exams, and you have, for the performing arts schools, you have essentially a performance that you have to give in order to get in. And so it puts another barrier, another obstacle in the way. I think that public schools are also great for someone who has the ability to move on as far as their sports talent goes. I think that you have a greater opportunity in a public school than a private school for your sports because of the varied amount of sports that you're able to participate in. In my high school, we went to state twice, maybe three times. It might have been three times.
Our soccer team was pretty good, too. Football team.
We had lots of my high school colleagues that were able to go on and participate in Division I college sports, which for... We were basically a baseball pipeline for a lot of colleges in Ohio, as well as a couple football players that went ended up going into D one and D two spots.
Anyone notable that we might have heard of that you can think of from your school off the top of your head?
Not that I can.
And let me ask you. So, like, so what is the problem? So, in terms of private schools, what do you think is like the biggest critique you have of private schools? And like, what do they struggle? Is it like, you know, the cost? Do you feel like it's maybe like, you know, the elitist attitude that some people might have, you know, like, you know, the snooty, you know, the snooty McHighbrows or something like that?
To be honest, as someone who wasn't,
please be honest,
wasn't a part of a private school, I've never actually had that experience. So it would be a little unfair of me to make a judgment. I think that my judgments on private schools are all pretty stereotypical, only because I didn't personally have that experience.
Okay.
I think that cost is a barrier for a lot of people. I think that's a huge one. That's probably the biggest one when parents are considering whether to do public or private school for their kids.
You want
to
take a guess on how much our high school costs? So we went to Jesuit High School.
$5,000 a semester?
Let's go for a whole year. And Saeed, chime in. Like, how much do you think? But it's more than $5,000.
Dr. Cruz was accurate.
Was it 10?
No, Dr. Cruz was accurate. It's a $5,000 a semester, a $10,000
a
year.
Okay, so I was right.
Yeah,
and that's a huge burden on families, especially families that have multiple children, mm-hmm. as well as families that are, you know, the average income in the United States is still less than $50,000 a year. And that's before taxes.
Yep.
And so to have to be able to invest $10,000 per child a year into something, that's your entire income if you are a one-parent household making less than $50,000 a year. Yep. And I think that that's just
context,
a huge barrier
for real quick, guys, people. Poverty line for a family of four in America is about $44,000.
Yeah. So the biggest one barrier would be cost for a lot of families.
Okay.
And I think that may just be cost prohibitive for them. If you are lucky and fortunate enough to be able to join private school, I think there are a lot of benefits, mostly from a networking alumni standpoint.
Right.
You have tons of previous graduates who have gone on to do every specialty that you're interested in, that have gone to every graduate school that you're interested in. You have a huge network of graduates as far as going into these harder to attain specialties and places.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's a huge benefit when you're dealing with this environment that we live in, and our atmosphere, social atmosphere currently in the U.S.
Okay, so I'm going to give you a couple of subjects, and so before we go into that, so Saeed, do you have any critiques about going to private school yourself? So I'll start off with myself. So I'll say going to private school, I'd say it definitely was definitely a more attentive environment. Like, you know what I mean? We definitely had more counselors and teachers show us time compared to, I feel like, you know, it was a public school with two or three as many times as students, you know what I mean? So I feel like that was the biggest benefit. The biggest loss was the cost, you know, because my parents were working hard. So I said, my mom, my dad, they were busing it. So I was staying with, like, you know, mom and papa a lot. So that was, like, the biggest thing, just missing out on them because they were working hard to support it as well, too. So I would agree with that. And also, I would say another critique I would have about it is that overall, it's a pretty less of a open environment. By open, I just mean, like, so for instance, with Jesuit, we had to be clean shaven, had to wear a certain dress code. So maybe it pronounces like a little bit more conformity that doesn't exist in the real life. You know what I mean? Because in the real life, in most careers, no one's telling you how to dress or what to do or something like that. So it sort of teaches you how to be part of a group rather than independent thought.
Yeah. I think that one thing that we've kind of haven't talked about really with this is the difference between private and public schools in their educational trajectory. I think that public schools give you an opportunity to transition into trades that give you, you know, a mechanic makes $22 to $25 an hour. Welders can make anywhere from $40 to $50 an hour. These are very high paying trade jobs that we're experiencing a huge deficit as far as our economic workforce in these skilled trades, carpenters, electricians, linesmen, and that private schools are very much designed to be a pipeline to traditional college, that we're actually missing out on the opportunity for our children who are able to have great talent in these trades and have great talent working with their hands and using their, you know, I don't know if you've ever met an electrician, but those guys are some of the smartest people as far as logical skill set goes that you can find. If you've got an issue and you need a logical thought process to figure it out, find yourself an electrician. They're some of the smartest people that I've ever met as far as logical thought processes go. and being able to hunt down and troubleshoot issues. They do a lot of the same problem-solving processes that we do in medicine, actually, as far as complex thought processes go. And I think that that's something that we undervalue a little bit in the traditional educational sphere. I think that that's something that in our generation, that when we were being raised, we were told that these jobs weren't good enough and that that wasn't a valuable trade. And I think that it really is, because every building you've ever stepped in has been worked on by an electrician, by a carpenter, by a contractor, by a, you know, a businessman, developer who's bought that property. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of opportunities for jobs here that we're currently at a huge deficit for. And I actually have a couple teenagers that I've had in clinic that I've counseled about their ability to be able to secure these jobs, because not, you know, a traditional college education isn't always the best path for everyone.
Dr. Cruz, remind me that I wanted to have a separate podcast on financial health, including college careers and student loan debt. Uh-huh. Remind me to bring you back for that episode. Okay. Brilliant, Dr. Cruz. Okay, but yeah, let's keep moving. I'm just gonna ask a couple things. You say public school or private school? On what you think is the best for these kids? So, for instance, sports. Public schools or public? Okay.
Public.
The curriculum. Let's say STEM. The STEM part of the curriculum.
Private.
Arts and music.
So that depends on which level of public school you go to. So I would say a public school with a magnet curriculum that's focused on arts. Is sometimes a direct pipeline to some of these arts colleges like Juilliard.
Yeah.
And I think that would be a benefit to children. I think that when you're interviewing private schools or interviewing public schools, that's a question you should ask.
Okay.
If your child is interested in the arts, how many of your students successfully match in arts colleges, successfully get into arts colleges? I think that's a special circumstance, because the arts are definitely in a non-traditional trajectory as far as how people end up getting into these programs.
Okay. Good thoughts. The next one, let's talk about diversity. Public school or private school?
So that one really depends on your geographical location. I think that there's a differential between public and private in an urban area, in a suburban area, and in a rural area.
Okay. Let's say rural.
So in rural in the north versus rural in the south, I think rural in the north, there is not very much diversity.
Okay.
In rural parts of Ohio where I grew up, we were very...
homogenous?
White. there's just not very much diversity. I think now that there's more expansion of people that are essentially expanding most of the large cities in the United States out into... They're spilling out of suburbia and into these more rural areas. I think that problem is slowly going away.
Okay.
But 15 years ago when we were in school, I think there was a very huge difference when you're dealing with public school in rural areas, suburban areas, and urban areas as far as the amount of diversity you had. Diversity in skin color as well as diversity in education, diversity in background, diversity in intelligence. I think there was less of a mix as there is now. I think nowadays there's a lot more, especially in between med school and residency, I did a little bit of substitute teaching for Douglas County Schools in Western Georgia. And I did see a lot more diversity in the schools throughout that county. Douglas County, for anyone who's not aware of the Atlanta area, is west of Atlanta, so it would be considered more of a suburb of Atlanta than it would be considered a rural area, as it had been in years past. In the last 15 years since Katrina in 2005, that area has really boomed as far as its population. And I think that it's gotten, it's really grown in its diversity as far as its racial diversity.
Okay. And then, but you definitely feel like urban areas definitely going to be, whether or not it's public or private, definitely going to be more diverse than your rural areas more often than that. Would you say?
I'd say that's probably fair.
Okay.
That's probably a fair assumption.
Okay. Next one. So let's go with extracurricular activities. So like, you know, after school, like, you know, key club, like engineer club, stuff like that, public or private school?
Private would be, have more opportunities for those after school programs.
Okay.
I think a lot of the after school programs that they have available for public schools are essentially pay to play.
Okay.
And that there are some that are funded, government funded as well. Mm-hmm. large majority of them are parents are paying for these after school programs so that because they don't have child care until they get off work.
True. I did not realize that. Okay. And then last one, opportunity to go to the next level of either education or the next level of your career.
Well, I think that you have opportunities to do both.
Okay.
For public schools, I went to a very small rural public school and I'm a doctor. And I think that I went through a lot of trials and tribulations to get to that, but I still think that it's possible. I think that being in a public school doesn't necessarily put you at a disadvantage when it comes to higher education. I think that you get a chance and opportunity to prove yourself at each level.
Okay.
And I think that's really what makes the difference, is if you're able to get past that threshold to be able to be admitted, then you're able to shine.
Okay.
If you have the ability.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. All right. So let's move on to the next topic revolving school. Let's talk about the common issues that kids and parents would face. So, Dr. Cruz, I'm going to ask you. So as far as kids face, as far as you can name any three issues that you think that are most important for kids starting back school right now. So let's say a couple ones could be like, you know, their diet, their extracurricular activities, peer pressure, stuff like that. So what's one thing that you would want to, like, you know, warn parents about that their kids could be facing?
Well, I think that especially when we're dealing with kids in the preteens and teens age group, we're dealing with a lot of peer pressure, dealing with a lot of mental health issues in our preteen and teenage children nowadays. I think that the exterior stresses that we place on them as parents have a huge impact on that. And when we speak to our patients and counsel our patients on these subjects, we actually talk about ways to deal with that with our patients. And so the number one way to do that is teaching our kids time management.
Okay.
Giving them valuable time management skills, teaching them how to function without procrastination so that they're able to have effective learning strategies.
Okay. What do you think the biggest obstacles to time management is for kids? I would say maybe social media, the amount of screen time, because growing up, like, did you have a cell phone? Like, I had, like, a Razor flip phone when growing up, and that was about, like, what did you have? Like,
I didn't have my first cell phone until I was 15.
Okay.
Starting to drive.
Okay.
And I think that cell phones and social media can be a huge distraction for kids, and the American Academy of Pediatrics still recommends less than 2 hours of screen time a day for children in that preteen and teen age group, and so we also have to deal with the effects on our children's eyesight and vision years and years down the road from spending all this screen time, because our teachers are actually converting a lot of these educational platforms over to digital options. So our kids, instead of taking tests on pencil and paper like we used to, our children are taking tests on computers. I had to proctor a test for third graders where they were all on computers. And if I had to touch a computer in third grade, I think I'd be lost. and so they're spending so much screen time at school that we're not even realizing as parents.
Okay.
That all of our whiteboards now, they used to be chalkboards when we were in elementary school, got converted over to dry erase boards when we were in high school. Those are actually all digital touchscreen boards now in the large majority of schools. And so they're getting a lot more screen time than we intend as parents, and then they come home and we let them watch TV, we let them play on their phone, we let them play games, we let them surf the internet, and I think that we're losing a lot of our kids' time to screen time.
Okay.
That's a huge issue for parents in this generation.
Okay. So,
from a physical activity standpoint as well as from, you know, their vision.
Okay, so we got number one, time management, watch the screen time, including social media, computers, all that. What's the second thing that you feel like that parents should know to help their kids out with?
So I think to stay in that teenager age group, I think a lot of our kids are dealing with symptoms of anxiety and depression at younger and younger ages.
Okay.
And I think a lot of that stems a lot of that stems from the overscheduling of their time.
Okay.
I think that it's anxiety producing to give kids too many activities. We try so hard to teach them all of these different things, and I think that we're overscheduling our children.
Okay. And then by that, like, so how much, so like, do you, so you can just believe that kids just need time to chill, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just chill, be,
yeah.
And
they need time to just relax and be kids.
Okay.
And they need time to make friendships, bond with family. They need time to build these relationships so they know how to build healthy relationships moving forward in the rest of their lives.
What you mean, healthy relationships?
That's right.
Yeah. See that? Smart cookie. All right. And then besides that, so let me a third thing. Like, what else do you think is also an important issue that kids are facing today?
I definitely think that now that we're getting back to school from a population health standpoint, one of the huge things for elementary school age children that a lot of parents deal with is the newfound infections of head lice in these kids. Head lice. You'll come and elementary school kids get rounds and rounds of head lice all the time. And if any of you are parents out there, you'll nod and roll your eyes because it's just a chronic problem that we deal with. And so there are simple ways to deal with these issues for teachers as well as for parents. Number one thing is going to be to teach your kids not to share hats. Don't share hats with your friends. Head lice is spread by contact. And so the number one way to prevent that is to only wear your items. If your child is unfortunate enough to catch some head lice, it is okay for them to go to school while they're infected. There are a couple options for treatment as well. The most common ones are using a lice comb to mm-hmm. physically remove gnats, as well as using some of the shampoos out there. The biggest thing that you're going to want to do to prevent spread is to wash all of the cloth in your home with hot water. So we're talking bed linens, surfaces of couches, carpets need cleaned thoroughly. These are things that will help your child preventing the spread of head lice throughout your home if your child is unfortunate enough to bring it home from school.
So say my child is infected with lice, like how soon can they come back to school once they've been discovered to have lice?
So the American Academy of Pediatrics actually recommends that children can go back the next day after they've been diagnosed with head lice. With proper treatment on board, they're able to actually still participate in school. And I think that that's a huge thing, a huge change in the recommendations from 10 years ago, that they were to stay out of school until you weren't able to visibly see any nits. And that's a huge thing as far as kids missing school getting behind on their schoolwork.
Okay, makes sense. Okay, so the three things for that Dr. Prue talked that might be important for parents to know about the kids: one, time management, make sure the kid, especially paying attention to the amount of screen time they get. Number two is the mental health. So said, if you feel like your kid is maybe a little overworked, making them a little anxious, a little bit depressed, maybe back off a little bit and spend some more quality time with your kids, especially with friends and family, to help them develop some relationships. And then the third one is lice. So I said, lice, as for the American Association of Pediatrics, make sure you wash everything, especially anything with cloth, thoroughly with hot water. And once you do that, the kids can probably go back to school the next day. Always make sure you get checked. You check in with your doctor before you make any decision like that. Now, as far as things for the parents. So, as far as parents, now I'm talking to the parents. So parents want to, the parents want to make some decisions for their kids, of course, and which I can believe in. They're kids. They want to do the best interest of the kids. So, I want to start you off on the number one issue for parents is diet. So, I know my friends a lot. On one patient asked me, is it okay if I start my 12-year-old on a vegetarian diet? They believe they achieve better health results through the vegetarians. They want to spread it to their kids. What's your opinion on what's your opinion on like what diet that especially like the preteen teenager kids should be on? Should they be on a vegetarian? Should they choose their own diet? What's your opinion on that?
So there's a huge array of diet modifications that are out there right now: keto, paleo, vegan, vegetarian. The list is as long as the days are. And so you really have to be careful in the options that you select for your children, especially when they're in that critical growth phase of their preteen and teen years. Mm-hmm. As far as vegetarian diets go, you do have the ability to get all of the nutrients that your children require through a vegetarian diet. The biggest risk there is going to be calorie intake, making sure that your children get enough calories in order to not only maintain their weight, but also maintain their brain function. Mm-hmm. When you send the brain into a starvation response, your brain, you do not have good short-term memory, you do not sleep well, you do not function at your best.
Okay.
And I think with our kids needing their short-term memory for education more and more heavily, that that's something that you'll have to consider, is making sure that if you're going to do a vegetarian diet, that you're calculating out the amount of calories and making sure that your children are getting enough. A lot of those wonderful leafy green vegetables and fruits that we have, they're high fiber and high volume, but they're not calorically dense. Okay. And I think that's one thing that is a risk. It's possible. You can definitely get everything that you need from a vegetarian diet.
So what if a parent...
But the risk is there.
What if a parent's just like, no, like, what if... So do you think the kids should choose their own diet, or do you think the parents should have the right to step into their diet?
I think that once you're dealing with teenagers, you have a lot of conflict as a parent about whether or not you're going to give them autonomy, the autonomy to start to make these own choices, these choices on their own, versus giving them more of a heavier guiding hand. And I think that that one is an individual basis, on an individual basis, really. I think you have to decide with your children about if they're interested in a fad diet, if they're interested in becoming vegan or becoming vegetarian. I think that it's really an opportunity for you to use it as a teaching moment and say, show me examples of how these diets are going to be healthy for you.
Okay.
And then you have it used, can use it as an opportunity to teach them about the different levels of vitamins, minerals, macronutrients that their bodies need to function. And you can use it as a great nutritional education tool.
So what if they're like, I want to do the Beyonce lemon pepper and cayenne diet water diet? what would be your advice if they really want to do something like that? And say, for instance, they were getting peer pressure, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just to look a certain way, so they want to do that diet. And, you know, because of the social media, especially, you know, they see, you know, this is what they think is the norm.
Yeah.
Like, how would you approach a child that's like that?
So I think that, number one, going over the risks of those types of nutritional supplements, for lack of a better term.
Okay.
Making sure that you understand the risks, as well as that you communicate the risks to your children. Of these types of fad diets, necessarily lemon water and cayenne pepper aren't necessarily going to hurt you.
Uh-huh.
And so if they're just downright driven to do it, I think that as long as it's not harming them, uh-huh. That it could be an option for them, but understand that it's going to be a huge placebo effect, that it's going to do nothing. and that there can be some minor, you know, consequences as well.
Okay.
Putting essentially hot, spicy water into your stomach, especially on an empty stomach, puts you at risk for reflux, puts you at risk for stomach ulcers in that specific situation.
Okay.
And I think if your child has medical problems that make them more prone to having issues, especially any respiratory issues, to where reflux could give them an asthma exacerbation, for example, that there may be more risk with that than with your run-of-the-mill child with no health problems.
Okay.
So I think that that would be something that you'd have to really decide on an individual basis in conjunction with your child's pediatrician.
Okay. That sounds like a plan to me. Now, speaking about other things that parents could be worried about, the second thing I wanted to bring up was sexual health. Mm-hmm. So as far as having discussions, so, you know, the good old birds and the bees conversation, mm-hmm. I'm not going to lie, I feel like a lot of our kids these days are learning the birds and the bees through, like, porn more often than, like, actual discussion with, like, you know, a provider or a doctor, you know what I mean? Do you feel like that's the new normal, or how do you think parents can help their kids find their sexual health? Or do you think it's something that the kids need to figure out on their own?
So I definitely think that that's something that traditionally as parents we try to shirk away from, we try to shy away from. And I think that that's something that in our current state of free information, and not all the large majority of this information is vastly incorrect. And I do spend a lot of my time in the clinic correcting sexual myths with teenagers.
Like what?
Like
for instance, like can you get pregnant with having just pregnant not with not having vaginal sex, like sort of thing, you know what I mean?
There are a slew of sexual myths out there. And I think that we probably have to have another podcast to go all the way through those.
Yeah. You can do that.
But to start out, I think that starting with age-appropriate sexual topics early is going to be your number one ally as a parent.
How
I think starting with kids, starting to discuss the proper terms for their private parts early when they're starting to talk and they're starting to ask questions. Usually we suggest, as far as the American Academy of Family Physicians goes, we suggest using age-appropriate terms for genitalia starting at the age of 5 and talking about teaching children about their bodies and how they work and how they function and the differences between their bodies and their bodies of the opposite sex from an anatomical standpoint and not from a sexual one. I think that we're in a huge shift in our culture as far as the sexualization of not only women but men as well as teens.
Okay.
They start to be sexualized earlier and earlier and earlier. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's an issue that we really fight with as parents, is to try to protect our children. And that's a difficult one, to be honest. It's something that your personal beliefs as a parent, as well as what your child is being exposed to, are huge factors involved in that. But as a physician, I usually start with age-appropriate topics when they come in for their well child visits.
Okay.
I start talking about age-appropriate sexual topics from the age of about 5, and then continue on with starting to talk to girls about their menstruation and menses about the age of 8, and then start talking about sexual topics at the age of 11 or 12 with the consent of their parents, as well as safe sex. Unfortunately, our kids are being exposed to sexual acts earlier and earlier and earlier, and that's something that before they have the opportunity to participate in these actions themselves, that you really have to be able to step in as a parent as well as a physician. And this goes for us as well as people who give advice to all of these children, that we have to be cognizant of that as well as respectful of the parents' wishes and beliefs. And I think that's really hard to balance.
Yeah, I can see how it could be super difficult. It's like growing up right now, I'm trying to think it's sort of crazy. Like, it's like, that all sounds good, but as a kid, as my parents, I'm trying to think how did my parents handle it? And honestly, it's hard to remember. Like, can you give me a tale? Like, how did your parents bring it up to you? Or did they even talk to you about it?
Let's see.
Because my parents are I got Jamaican parents, so they're pretty pretty old school. My mom was pretty much to the book when it came to sex. She was like, Chris, you better not have no girlfriend, no unwanted children.
Yeah.
Why, mom? Just don't. But why? She was just like, don't. And then my dad was just like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And just like most boys, I would say pornography was one of the things I learned. And then after that, seeing how pornography is not like real life at all.
Yeah, you have to unlearn all those habits.
My dad had to set me straight, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you had to learn all those habits that you learned from, unfortunately, from porn. And that, I was fortunate enough that my parents were pretty open with me. Being a woman, my mother was really the one that was the driving force as far as my sexual education as a child. And I think that it started probably a little later than what I counsel as a physician. We really started with, my first menses growing up and started talking about things then. And my mom was a huge proponent of birth control. And birth control can be used for a variety of reasons. Oral contraceptives, hormonal contraception can be used for a variety of reasons. And only one of them is the prevention of pregnancy. And a lot of teenage girls struggle with things like acne, with mood swings, with horrendously painful periods. And birth control can actually treat a lot of those issues. And a lot of parents are concerned about using those as treatments in their children, simply because they believe it'll encourage sexual activity. But I think that education is your friend in that sphere as far as being a parent goes, and that a well-educated kid is one that's able to make better decisions.
I agree. Okay. Now, let's talk about talk number 3. But yeah, that was a good idea. Definitely going to have another sexual health podcast. I think that could be a great idea. But number 3 that parents would worry about their kids about: bullying. So as you said, say your kid came back, a little bit of dirt on their face, some scratches, they got roughed up by a bully. Like, as a parent, how do you think that parents should handle their bullying? Should they, try and talk it out with their kid, talk about expectations? Should they ride down with the school with a metal bat, just looking for trouble? Like, what should they do?
I think that there's a variety of responses by parents for this.
Any of them with
a
bat?
And I think that your first instinct as a parent is to protect your child. And that's a really hard instinct to override, because really what we have to teach our children is resilience and their own ability to be able, the ability to be able to solve their own problems. And I think that that's a valuable tool that children need to learn. And I think the first, being bullied is never a great thing. It is always an awful thing that we try to raise good children so that they're neither the perpetrator nor the victim of these kinds of behaviors. But unfortunately, they do happen. And so talking to our children about ways to deal with bullying is another huge factor where education is going to be your friend. Right. There are a couple of different approaches that parents like to tout. The first one is going to be dismiss and delay. So if you're being threatened or being bullied, the child can say, you know, to say a distracting comment, can walk away, can talk about, distract their, essentially distract their aggressor, as far as a deflection tactic. There are also parents out there that are going to teach their children to stand up for themselves, whether that be physically, which we don't approve of, as far as the American Academy of Family Physicians goes.
But as far as the Jamaican Academy of Hard Knocks, no.
So I think that teaching your child the tools that they're going to use, I think that you should fill their toolbox with different options so that they're able to handle whatever situation comes at them. Whether that's teaching them self-defense courses or teaching them how to verbally deflect an aggressor, I think that those are both usable tools that children should learn. And I think that you should, especially teaching our girls to defend themselves in this day and age, is a huge thing as far as being able to defend yourself from an attacker.
Okay. What about online bullying? Like, how do you, as a parent, how do you respond to this new online bullying now that kids are online more than ever?
Yeah.
Do you think it's just simple as just, like, you know, blocking someone or turning it off? Or do you feel like it's just, or do you feel like that it's just going to keep on coming back at them and that you need other methods to deal with online bullying rather than what you just described?
Yeah, I think that online bullying presents certain, unfortunately, certain barriers to solutions. As far as the protection of the anonymity of your attacker, in the case of bullying, I think that it can provide a wall of protection to your attacker that your victim may not be able to surpass. And that's where blocking comes in. That's where monitoring your children's social media presence kicks in, as far as being able to protect them. As far as the easiest way to deal with an online bully is to bring it into reality. So if you have if your child has an online bully that is in their reality, that is also within their school, within their sports team, within their real life sphere, I think the easiest way to deal with that is to bring that into the real life sphere. And with screenshots, taking that to a trusted adult that's able to handle that situation. So if this online bullying situation is from someone in their class, taking that information to their principal, taking that information to the child's other parent, and having a discussion parent to parent about this behavior.
Are you talking about snitching?
I wouldn't suggest going head to head with another parent unless you have experience with that parent's temperament. The product of bullying, as far as what creates bullies to begin with, usually starts at home. With children's self-esteem at home. And I think that you have to be careful if you're going to try to go head to head with the bully's parent without some kind of mediator in the middle. I think that it would probably be wisest to take that to someone who is, I guess, a little bit less biased.
Okay. I agree with that. Just a third-party mediator, just to try and solve it out without a bat.
We do not condone violence.
This is America, so this isn't Jamaica. But I just say Jamaica just because it's very old school type of mentality. But as Dr. Cruz said, just teach your kids the tools, because they said in real life, when they get in the real world, they're gonna be having to face the exact same situation. Maybe not bullying, but they're gonna have, you know, coworkers that, you know, that they clash with, or someone or one of their neighbors that they just don't agree with. So it's important to teach them the tools from the young. Okay, so again, so as far as things for the parents that could be worried about their kids that we discussed with Dr. Cruz, we talked about diet and how important it is to have an open discussion about the risks and pros of whatever fad diets the child wants to begin, especially in the preteen area when their bodies are going to start growing and developing. Talked about sexual health on how it's important to not steer away from the topic, but instead embrace it and start at an early age using anatomically correct definitions of it and making sure that kids have an open discussion with their parents instead of going, as you said, on online pornography or talking with their friends, which are not real life examples of how sexual health is done. And the last one is bullying. So it's a big no-no. So do not start with physical violence. And do not directly have conflict with the parent of the bully. Instead, try and find a third-party mediator, and try and teach your kids tools like distract and
dismiss and delay.
Dismiss and delay, as well as for online bullying, make sure that you take screenshots or just take that online bullying to the public or bring it to attention to somebody else to get rid of that veil of anonymity that makes them be like a tough guy. So we call those internet gangsters. Everyone's an internet gangster until people find out. All right. And then besides that, so all in all, just to summarize what we talked about, guys, we talked really quickly about public versus private schools and the advantages and disadvantages to both. Topics that parents were concerned about for their kids. Diet, making sure that you have a discussion with your diets, pros and cons, especially during the preteen teen years. Sexual health and bullying. And for the kids, make sure that kids have their time adequately managed, especially screen time. Try and keep it less than 2 hours a day. Head lice is a bigger issue than you think, but it's not the end of the world. As long as it's properly treated, you can possibly go back to school the next day and continue learning. And then besides that, the child's mental health. If you feel like they're getting stressed out or burnt out, maybe take them a step back a little bit. Stop that extracurricular karate or cello lessons and just let them enjoy being a kid while they still have it. Because trust me, as I said, I miss those years. You know, I miss high school not doing anything. Such a simple life.
Are you trying to say adulting is hard?
it's not as easy as what they make. It's not as sexy. Not as sexy as it looks. We just make it look good, guys. And then besides that, are you ready to help answer some core questions? So we show sure. Usually. So on Quora, you can find me at Christian Bramwell at Quora, just my name simply, and you can find me on Quora. And I like to answer questions. So I said, with these questions, take it with a grain of salt. And still, if you do have true questions about if these are affecting your health, go see a medical professional about them. But Syed, you ready to get us started on the score questions?
Okay. Question number one, which grains offer the highest quality of protein and lowest levels of starch?
So you're looking for grains with the highest protein. So first of all, as far as the grains to avoid that are just purely starch, it'd be anything white or enriched. So as I said, with white or enriched, it just means that it's been pulverized to the fact that all the fiber and all the shape has been taken out. So the number one thing I would recommend, as I said, would be something like quinoa. So quinoa is a natural grain, but it's full of protein and full of fiber. So what makes a grain good carbohydrate is that if you take the carbohydrate and the fiber ratio, it should be a lower carbohydrate ratio and high in fiber. So that when you subtract the fiber from the carbohydrates, it should be less. You know what I mean?
A good rule of thumb with grains is going to be whole is best. Whole grain breads, whole grain flour, whole grain, oats as far as if you're eating oatmeal for breakfast, which, by the way, is a great way to lower your cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
You want those non-processed grains in your diet because they are complex carbohydrates. And those are not only what gives you long-lasting energy, but they also decrease the amount of hunger that you feel in between meals because mm-hmm. they have staying power. What I mean by that is that it takes your body longer to digest them. And so they actually stay in your digestive system longer. And so your stomach is not telling your brain that you're hungry in an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with some processed foods like processed white flour, white breads, cakes, pastries, these things produce a sugar high mm-hmm. as far as your blood glucose levels. And those are the things that they get digested and utilized very quickly. Mm-hmm. And when they do, they get digested all at once and they're more likely to be turned into fat.
Okay. Yep. You heard Dr. Cruz. Remember, If you're looking, whole grains is the best. All right, good, sir. What's the next one?
Does pure protein have any flavor?
So I'm thinking of like protein powder. So like protein powders and protein bars, stuff that's very high in protein, usually does not taste the greatest. You know what I mean? In terms of the stuff that tastes the greatest, carbs and fats usually make things taste very, very good. You know what I mean? So for instance, a lean piece of chicken, like, you know what I mean? It's not exactly the tastiest thing, or like a protein bar or protein powder. They're fairly tasteless. It's like, you know, the saturated fats and the simple carbohydrates are probably, I would say, the tastiest. Mm-hmm. And then the more, like I said, the more less fat, less carbohydrates you get, and more protein, it's going to taste like a little bit more bland, where it's not as, definitely not as delicious. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's why when you get, like you said, the protein, you do have to mix it with something a little bit to add some taste in it, whether or not it's like a little bit of like a fruit in your smoothie or some milk. I would say that the more protein and more lean protein you are eating, the less it tastes better.
I think that protein has, pure protein is not something that you have in whole food diet. What is we recommend as far as physicians is a minimally processed diet. So we're talking baked and grilled meats, steamed fresh or frozen vegetables. Mm-hmm. And those things are never pure protein. As far as the commercial protein powders, protein bars, protein shakes, I even saw little granola protein balls in Costco the other day. These things are designed for intense activity, and they're designed for calorie repletion after intense activity. And I think the large majority of people do moderate activity at best.
Okay.
I think that your professional athletes are really the people that these products are marketed towards.
Okay.
And I think that the marketing really pushes for people that do moderate intensity activity to think that they need these extra protein sources, protein powders, protein shakes. So I think that that's something that if you're interested in creating a specific regimen, talking to your registered dietitian, nutritionist, or your physician about what types of calorie-focused diets, as well as maybe fat-focused, low-fat, low-carb diets, I think that that's a great resource for you as far as building a diet that works best for you. There are a lot of non-experts out there giving advice on diet. And I think that
you're telling me the people on the infomercials aren't experts.
I think that you do have resources to reach out to that not only have the training to give you accurate information, but also better results.
True.
And I think that you should use those resources.
Okay. So over and all, so the chances are you don't need too much of the high protein or protein only foods, as unless you're working out to play in the NFL or balling to go to the NBA. Besides that, just come out with your doctor with a nice minimally processed amount of food in your diet, and make sure that the protein is overall cleaner sources of protein, so no fried chicken or anything like that, guys.
What is the rotting of proteins in the cold?
Rotting of proteins in the colon? I get that right?
Yeah. See, I think it might be like someone might have just said the wrong terminology, because I said proteins necessarily doesn't rot in our gut. It just gets broken down. You know what I mean?
So yeah, they may mean, if you mean digestion by that, whoever the reader is that submitted that question, if you mean protein digestion actually happens in the stomach, mm-hmm. not in our colon. Small intestine is actually designed to process carbohydrates, mm-hmm. and our large intestine is actually designed to give our body water balance. So it tells our body whether or not to deposit more water into our stool versus pulling water out of our stool. Mm-hmm. That's where a lot of people deal with constipation from, mm-hmm. Is having stool or digested material in their colon that does not pull water into it. So it does not cause what we call an osmotic diuresis into the stool. Mm-hmm. And so as far as rotting of protein in our colon, not a thing, myth.
Dr. Cruz, I did have a couple of questions just to follow up on. What is a visible impact of bullying on a kid's mental health? Stuff like sleeplessness, acne, or anything?
So there can be a lot of psychosomatic complaints produced by children that are dealing with bullying. The body, your mental health affects your physical health. And so you can see some side effects of bullying in children as far as physically sleep irregularity, as far as sleep disturbances, nightmares. You can also see appetite suppression or appetite stimulation. You can have children that induce stress eating as well, and so as a coping mechanism for bullying. You can also see children with higher levels of anxiety and depression, as well as children that then develop thoughts of suicidality from this severe bullying. And if you ever have any thoughts of hurting yourself, this is for our teenagers out here listening to the podcast. There is a hotline, the teen suicide hotline, that we'll put up right here down at the bottom of the screen. And please give that a call. You are not alone. You are not the only person dealing with this. And reach out for help, because it's there.
All right. What are two health issues that parents face during this back-to-school time?
So parents can also face sleep deprivation, as well as feeling overwhelmed, having thoughts of anxiety of sending their kids back to school. I have multiple friends that had posted on social media in the last couple days when their kids went back to school, talking about how they were up until 4 a.m. getting the kids' things ready for school.
4 a.m.?
Yes, yes. What? If you have multiple kids, tracking down 4 backpacks and 4 sets of school supplies and 4 lunches and 4 outfits for school the next day, can be quite a overwhelming task. You'll find out in a few years. and so one of the huge things for parents is to schedule a little bit of me time. The American Academy of Psych... Oh, no, let me get this right. The American Psychiatrist Association actually recommends 30 minutes of free time for parents every day in order to maintain your own mental health and well-being. And I think that is really hard to get in. 30 minutes of just me time.
I'm
going to
say that's not enough. 30 minutes only?
Well, when you're a parent, it becomes... It's
about the kids.
Always, yes. Yeah, it's your me time or your personal time is very limited. And that's something that a lot of parents struggle with, is having that time to themselves. And if you're fortunate enough to have a partner or have a two-parent household, you can kind of rely on each other for that, as far as being able to carve out a little bit of time for yourself in the day. And there's also the opportunity for our stay-at-home parents that are able to get that half an hour in after the kids go to school, versus the parents who work who are able to get that half an hour time in before they go to bed. The hugest thing for that is going to be sleep hygiene. Sleep deprivation is a huge thing with parents, especially with new parents, parents of newborns. In those first 6 months of life, children rarely sleep more than 6 hours at a time. And so parents run on a chronic sleep deficit. And so having a good sleep hygiene routine is going to help you to be able to deal with everything. So avoiding screens for the last 2 hours before bed.
Okay.
Avoiding the television, the cell phone, being in low light. Do not do activities in your bed. Don't watch TV in your bed. You have to train your body that your bed is for sleep.
Okay.
And that usually takes about a month. It's a process. It is not a quick fix. It is not like Ambien where you take it and you fall asleep immediately. It is a lifestyle change, but it's really the best lifestyle change. True. To be able to care for yourself and care for your well-being. Parents that don't get enough sleep, or just people, adults that don't get enough sleep, actually put themselves at risk for memory disorders in their older years. So once we get up into our 50s, 60s, and 70s, patients and physicians as well, because we deal with sleep deficits all the time, having those chronic sleep deficits are actually linked to loss of short and long-term memory. And so it puts you at higher risk for other issues, dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, things that we haven't really attributed the medical causes of just yet. We haven't found out whether or not they're truly genetically driven or if there's some environmental influence. And I think that reducing your risk for those things in the future so that you can have the longest, healthiest life that you can is crucial.
Okay. I gotta get better at sleep hygiene myself as well too. Like, I just can't help it.
It's hard.
I just gotta watch, you know, a little bit of something before I tune out.
It's hard, yeah.
I'm working on it.
It's not an easy task.
You mentioned, Dr. Cruz, you mentioned being a parent before. What's the biggest impact being a parent has had on the work you do as a doctor or the way you work as a doctor?
Well, I have to say that there is a little bit of qualification there. I am a step parent. I'm not a full-time parent. And so that's grossly different between my situation than other parents that are full-time parents. I see some of my colleagues who have who had children in residency, mm-hmm. Or who waited to have kids until they were attending physicians, versus some of my friends that chose to have children earlier in their 20s as well, who are in different career paths. And I think that it's a different path, really, with balancing being a physician and a parent. I think that I'm fortunate enough to have a great partner and a great husband who is able to help and be there when we have my stepdaughter with us, and that we're able to schedule our time to be able to be there and be present with her when she's here with us. And I think that it's harder to balance as a full-time parent than it is as a step-parent. I think as a full-time parent that you are being pulled in all sorts of different directions at once, and being a full-time parent and a full-time physician, especially as a woman, you're told that you gotta do it all. And I think that for the number one advice I could give to other women physicians who are thinking about becoming a parent or thinking about becoming a step parent and becoming involved in a child's life is that you can't do it all. The mantra that we can do it all and that we can do it and no, we don't need any help from anyone it's really a falsehood that's perpetrated throughout our culture. And I think that you have to understand and give yourself some grace.
Okay.
Really, is that you can't do it all, and that's why you have your support. That's why you have your team. And if that team is your parents, your friends, your family, or your partner, that you use that team to help build the best rounded environment for your child.
I agree. You hear that?
Dr. Cruz, what role has your background in a rural community and a rural environment had in the focus that you have in opioid research?
Yeah, with the opiate as well as other controlled, other recreational drugs, other illegal recreational drugs. I think that that's mm-hmm. It's actually quite a similar story as far as the types of issues that people in rural areas are dealing with when it comes to mm-hmm. illegal substances as well as people in urban areas. It's really much more prevalent than it's painted to be as far as rural areas go. You're living in a resource poor area with very little resources, truly, as far as activities for children, access to after school activities, access to other opportunities. And so there's a huge issue there as far as the ability to be able to unfortunately be exposed to that stuff.
Idle hands make devil's work. I forget the phrase it is.
That's not necessarily the point that I'm going for. I think that there's a lot of opportunity for there to be creative growth in having idle time for children.
Okay.
That it's not necessarily that if they have free time that they're going to do bad things with it.
Okay.
But there is a lot more access to those illegal substances in areas where it's not as tightly monitored by our police intervention and ability to have funding for proper law enforcement resources that we just don't have out in the rural areas. I think there's a lot more opportunity for the infiltration of these kinds of things into our environment. And unfortunately, it's something that a lot of people have to deal with. A lot of people that are exposed to drugs and alcohol as a part of their family experience. There are a lot of families in rural areas that are torn apart by drugs. Different types of drugs for urban versus rural areas as far as the prevalence is. You see more methamphetamines, alcohol use, as well as essentially the less expensive drugs.
Less expensive drugs, okay.
In rural areas, but you also see a lot of designer drugs in more affluent areas that are being abused as well.
Like so, the spice, like a synthetic marijuana or...
Yeah, synthetic marijuana. Spice is a specific problem simply because K2 was legal for a long time prior to... Yeah, it was only just recently added to the list of Schedule 1 drugs.
Yeah, want to have a good night, K2 and the Four Locos, and you're having a good night.
I don't have any experience with that one, but...
you never had one Four Loco? You ever had a Four Loco growing up?
Oh no, they removed the caffeinated portion of Four Locos when I was a sophomore in college.
Oh, okay.
But I think that's a special circumstance. Really. Okay.
But in the urban areas, the designer drugs, you get some, like the higher stuff, like you know, cocaine, probably a little bit more prevalent.
Yeah, especially there are a bunch of documentaries about drug use, especially in Atlanta.
Okay.
Really. There are a lot of really great informational documentaries on, you know, Atlanta in the early 90s and the way that drugs ravaged the city then.
Okay.
As far as crack cocaine or methamphetamine or heroin.
Okay.
And there's been a huge sweep across rural areas of the United States as far as the uptick in heroin use as well as heroin deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that comes from the substances that are used to cut the drug or substances that are used to modify the presence of different chemicals that are inside those drugs.
Okay.
We're actually dealing with an outbreak of that here in Augusta as well.
And they do it just to make the drug last longer, sell more of it, make more money?
Make it more addictive.
Okay, make it more addictive.
So that customers are coming back for more.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it's something that's, it's a non-regulated market, and so it's a very... unfortunately very dangerous, and there are a lot of people that are dying from these drugs, and it's something that it's a huge public health issue.
Okay. It seems like you're very very motivated to get something to get it done, as said. Like, so okay, so I can't wait to see how your research, I'm gonna wait to see how your poster goes, and I can't wait for you to see you up at NAPREG with the rest of our residents.
Yes, I'm excited. It's gonna be a good trip.
Okay. Again, everybody, this was Being Health D with Dr. Bramwell, featuring Dr. Cruz today and co-host Saeed Bramwell Gordon. Thank you guys for listening. As said, if you want more of the links that we talked about, check in the profile below as well as the bio. And then besides that, guys, check out healthd.com for regular health tips. Remember, guys, be happy and be healthy. Peace.
The opinions provided should not be viewed as medical advice. And remember, please consult with your doctor before making any changes to your diet or habits. Thanks again for listening, guys.